Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's deputy features editor.
This week we'll be discussing China's global spy network, we'll be looking back on a non-stop decade of political history, and we'll be examining the toxicity of women's book clubs.
Laura, we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon. The magazine went to press about an hour and a half ago. Our cover line this week is The She Files, Nigel Inkster on China's global spy network. Can you talk us through how that came about?
Yes, so Nigel Inkster is the former Director of Operations and Intelligence for MI6, and he's written this piece about how China's demand for intelligence goes far beyond anything Western intelligence agencies would typically try and gather. He says that they're collecting data on everything from government websites to think tanks, human rights organisations and individuals. And the peg really came about on Monday when two British men were charged with breaking the Official Secrets Act for allegedly passing information to China. So Nigel looks at why and how China goes about its espionage. And to discuss further, we spoke with Ian Williams, author of Fire of the Dragon, China's New Cold War, and historian and Guardian columnist Simon Jenkins. Ian, our cover this week looks at development of Chinese espionage. And you've said before that China seems to be winning in the espionage war. Could you take us through your thinking?
Well, I think as Nigel makes clear in his piece, the sheer scale and breadth of Chinese espionage is quite staggering. And it's very different from what we have over the years assumed or labelled as espionage, because it involves formal and informal techniques. It involves anybody or anything as an asset to gather intelligence. And I think it's kind of summed up in the Chinese word qing bao, which means intelligence and information. And there is a very much a crossover between the two in the Chinese information and intelligence gathering machine. I think where I would be wary is it's sometimes described as a thousand grains of sand approach or a vacuum cleaner approach because of the sheer scale of information which China seeks to gather. But that almost implies a scattergun approach, whereas I think it's far more focused than that. I think China knows what it wants, particularly on the technological front, and knows the many different methods, formal and informal, by which it's able to do that. You know, this has been going on for some time, and in many ways, the surprise is it's taken this long for Western governments to open their eyes to it, which I think is very much a product, as much as anything else, in the changing perceptions of China.
Ian, could you just briefly take us through some of those strategies, the formal and informal, as you described it?
Well, I think it ranges from cyber espionage, where China, by most estimates, has been perhaps the world's most prolific economic spy in cyberspace in terms of gathering know-how and technology, through to informal tie-ups in academia through funding various joint projects which involve military or CCP-linked entities, through to individual researchers. So you've got a whole range of different methods by which data is gathered. And of course, increasingly explicit policies in China requiring companies or individuals or scientists to share that know-how with the intelligence agencies, to cooperate with them and with the military establishment.
Simon, Nigel writes in his piece about China's global network of covert police stations as one of the examples of how it uses espionage. That's something that we haven't seen from other countries before, isn't it?
I'm not totally expert in the answer to that question, but whether we have or not, What sort of interests me, and I've been to China two or three times, but I'm not an expert in China, is how we sort of assume that every country is aspiring to behave like we do. And when they don't behave like we do, we hold it to their account. I'm just not... Everything China's done seems to be the sort of thing that a country like China would do, not least in London. And I had brief acquaintance with their operation in London at one point. It was incompetent, it was expensive, it was thorough, it was extremely tedious. I didn't think they were getting anything very helpful to them. They were talking to all the wrong people. But to me, it is not really the point. The point is they behave as Chinese people behave abroad. They do not behave as we behave abroad.
What do you think Britain's response should be to this? I mean, the peg for our story this week was that two young men were charged. So that, I mean, are we starting to kind of ramp up the response, do you think?
I mean, I was not surprised and I wasn't terribly worried. I couldn't believe they were getting anything particularly useful out of those two. It was absolutely classic, just a more or less incompetence out of a pretty incompetent government, but with behind it a hugely powerful industrial superstructure. So, I mean, it didn't worry me at all. I shrugged. And of course, the whole kind of great caboodle of British counter-espionage is wheeled out and, if you like, overinterpret it. That's all I'm really saying.
I mean, it is a puzzling one. Obviously, we're limited as to what we can say about it at this point, as to what value these individuals might have held for China and why it should pursue them. But it does coincide with action in other countries on the continent, in Belgium, in Germany, where we've had a number of arrests, where it is a little clearer what they were after in terms of technology and know-how with more explicit military capabilities. I do think so, though, to return to something that Simon was saying about the different capabilities, different ways that countries go about things. One of the things that's always puzzled me with China, the scale of Chinese espionage and the scale of information gathering, formal and informal, is the ability to interpret all this stuff. Because, you know, one of the key elements of intelligence, as I understand it, is not so much in what you gather, it's the sense you make of it. And if you've got so much data being taken in, can you really make sense or make use of it in a meaningful way? I mean, we saw during the Soviet days, the KGB had a department dedicated to stealing technology, reverse engineering it, and trying to make its own comparable devices. But it didn't work, A, because the CIA rumbled it and were feeding it bad tech, and because by its very virtue, you were always behind, because the thing you're stealing from isn't standing still, it's moving forward. And so I still have wonder about the ability of the Chinese state, this information vacuum cleaner. And the gathering of foreign know-how and tech has been fundamental to the whole reform and opening process that we've had over the years. But you know, you do wonder about the capability of China to digest it, even given that there are great advances in artificial intelligence and machine learning.
Ian, there's a theory that in the kind of short to medium term, authoritarian countries are kind of more capable, are stronger. But when you look at them from the longer term, they actually turn out to be more brittle and they're more prone to fall apart. What do you make of that?
I think that's very true. I think during the last Cold War, there was an expression about not treating the Soviet Union like it was 10 foot tall. There was a sort of sense of not wanting to exaggerate its capabilities. And I think there's a similar situation with China. It's easy to look at the sheer range and breadth and scale of its intelligence operations and think, oh my God, this is overwhelming. But I take the view that China is essentially very brittle economically, and is not as politically as secure as some people would believe. And I do think that for all the capabilities that they have, I have doubts about their ability to digest the vast amount of intelligence and information that is going to Beijing. There's also a sense as well that you look at some of these recent intelligence spying cases and you think to yourself, well, why would someone do that in the case of China? Because as with Russia, there's no real ideological attraction to Xi Jinping's China or Putin's Russia. that leaves, is it money? Is it a dislike or a discomfort with your own government? It makes it more difficult and more complex, at least in the last Cold War. People were spying for ideological reasons, however misplaced they might be.
When you mentioned Russia there, do you think there's somehow a sense that Chinese espionage is perhaps less malevolent than other types of espionage, say Russian?
I think it's broader. I think there's an extent to which many aspects of the way the two countries behave are converging in terms of the way they conduct espionage, the way they behave in cyberspace, for instance, whether that's through disinformation, through sabotage, through theft. But certainly, I think I would say it's not so much a difference between the way the two countries have behaved, although certainly Russia is much more malevolent, is much more prepared to sabotage and damage, whereas China has tended to work within the system. It's tended to look at what it can get from the system in terms of whether that's stealing know-how or acquiring know-how. And don't forget that, you know, there's no point in theft if someone's going to give it to you, which has often been the way with businesses and academia in rather sort of naive tie-ups with China or forced technology transfers. So there is a sense, yes, that China has been more prepared to work within the system and get what it can out of the system rather than being a malevolent power of sabotage, which is what we've seen with Russia. But I do think there is a much more of a convergence between them now than we've seen before.
And finally, Ian, I think it's often observed that the difference between China and the USSR is that our trade is kind of far more integrated when it comes to China, that we couldn't survive without access to the Chinese economy. Do you think that espionage is really just kind of the cost of doing business with China?
I certainly think that's the way it has been seen. I think that's changing, and the arrests we've seen recently, the more full-blooded condemnation that's been coming from the intelligence agencies and from politicians is a product of changing perceptions of China. I think it's certainly been the case that a lot of this, particularly the cyber theft, for instance, and was seen very much as the cost of doing business with China, the price of doing business, that this is what you got. And to some extent, cyber espionage was an inevitable part of the sort of catch-up process that a lot of other countries had engaged in over the years technologically. But more recently, I think the mood has changed considerably, and that's primarily because of the greater hostility that's come from Xi Jinping's China, combined with the much more explicit laws that now exist, requiring companies and individuals to cooperate with the intelligence agencies. I mean, you've got no choice. There isn't an option if they want to use these companies and academics, combined with quite explicit laws and policies in Beijing to see that know-how is transferred to the security forces and to the military. So whereas before, perhaps it was more of a fudge, yes, you knew that some of this know-how going out of the universities was finding its way into the military establishment. Now it's much more explicit, and this explains why I think governments are now much more worried about the flow of know-how and the sheer scale of that flow to Beijing.
Ian and Simon, thank you very much for joining.
Laura, what did you enjoy from the magazine this week?
Lots of things, of course, but just a few highlights, really. One is Roy Sutherland's column this week, where he imagines what it would be like to show Louis XIV your life. And he says almost everything you have would amaze him, whether it's your flat screen TV or your ability to order stuff off Amazon. He says the only thing that wouldn't amaze him would be your housing situation and your sexual opportunity. So I enjoyed that.
And he's particularly rude about, Is it Chiswick?
He's very rude about Fulham.
Fulham.
And Clapham. Clapham and Fulham come in for a bit of a beating from Rory. I also enjoyed, well, Melissa Kite is getting married, which I'm sure regular listeners will be very pleased to hear. And Gus, you've interviewed the late Daniel Dennett, and I believe it's the last interview he ever did, so perhaps you could tell us about that.
So I spoke to the philosopher Daniel Dennett shortly before he died over Zoom, and we talked about his theory of consciousness, which sounds kind of very esoteric, but actually his kind of what he's trying to do is to bring consciousness into the realm of science and to say this isn't some kind of ineffable mystery. This is something we can explain, and it's something that, you know, if once there's enough research that's done, we will understand how it works, and it'll be the same as, you know, working out how the pancreas works or something like that. So he's a kind of deflationary theorist. He wants to get rid of the mystery of consciousness. And we also spoke about AI and multiculturalism and lots of different things. So, yeah.
Sounds intense. I should also just say that Douglas Murray writes a very intriguing column this week from St. Helena, where he's been, and we are going to hear an extract of that now.
Of course, the most famous prisoner to have been on this island was Napoleon. One night, we had a glorious dinner at his island abode, Longwood House, which has been magnificently restored. The view from Napoleon's quarters is one of the best on the island, which is saying something. It is like a mini world out there, with vast mountain crops, lush greenery, and of course thousands of miles of empty ocean. People are no longer brought up to believe in the great man view of history, but you cannot doubt it here. There is a startling aura about the place. The idea that this man required battalions of British troops to be stationed on the island, forts on every hilltop, and a fleet of British ships surrounding it just to keep him confined, is testament to the fact that whatever else he got wrong, he was a great man. One of my friends caught me alone in Napoleon's coffee parlour, staring out across the South Atlantic. "What are you thinking about?" he asked. "Europe, Moscow," I told him.
It's a very intriguing column, isn't it, Laura?
I think it raises more questions than it answers. The next article that we're going to talk about is Tim Shipman's piece on hyperhistory. Tim has a new book out, and he's referring in his piece to the breathless last 10 years in political history and why exactly that seems to have happened. He says at the start of his career, he was mainly covering Blair and Brown, and then suddenly around 2015, everything suddenly became very turbocharged.
Tim, you write in the magazine this week about a breathless 10 years of political history. Can you tell us how it began?
Well, I think it began for me. I joined the Sunday Times as political editor in 2014, almost 10 years to the day, actually, that we're talking. And it was all fairly becalmed then. David Cameron looked relatively in control. And then about 3 months later, we got this poll saying that Scotland might go independent. And the whole of Westminster rushed to Scotland to try and save the Union. And they pulled it off in the end. And I don't think it's stopped being chaotic since, but a lot of the lessons that they thought they'd learnt from that referendum were then grafted onto what happened in 2016. They thought the Remain campaign thought it could go and run a kind of Project Fear on the economy. That didn't work. Different set of voters, different set of priorities. And I think the sort of chaos unleashed by both of those referendums and all the kind of stuff that fell out from it afterwards, we're still living with all of that since, really.
I mean, one of the things that I kind of took from your piece was that, in a way, a lot of the chaos was caused almost by accident. So we had things like the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which was designed to kind of keep the coalition together, which, you know, later on under Theresa May caused no end of problems.
Yeah, I saw David Cameron the other day saying that actually it wasn't a terrible mistake and it would give us stability now, but that certainly wasn't the experience during the May years, where what she really needed to do in order to pass a deal was to persuade at least one group of people that her deal was preferable to the alternatives. And the people who wanted no deal and the people who wanted a referendum stuck to their guns, thinking that they were going to get their way. And at no point was she able to sort of close off the door and force people to choose between two slightly sort of unpalatable options as far as they were concerned, and choose the lesser evil. Everyone stuck to their own preferences. And it was, you know, the inability of a prime minister to sort of say, we're going to have an election and we're going to have a new parliament, was really sort of problematic for her. And, you know, ultimately, MPs lost confidence in the May government long before the May government ceased to be around. And she had no ability to change it. So you had a government that had basically no support in the House of Commons trying to pass major, you know, a major kind of international treaty. And it was completely sort of hamstrung by, you know, what was then a piece of the Constitution. And I think, you know, a lot of us think that was a good thing to get rid of. Mm. And, you know, we're obviously sitting in a time now where Rishi Sunak is trying to make up his mind about when to call an election. Had we still got the Fixed Term Parliament Act, you could argue that we'd know when it was and everyone would be working to that and we wouldn't have quite so much feverish speculation. But it does still give the Prime Minister a kind of at least one card in his ever-dwindling hand that he can still play.
Tim, I think you write in your book, No Way Out, which is out in all good bookshops, that part of the reason May found it difficult was because she found it difficult to kind of build a relationship with Labour because of the anti-Semitism scandal. And I think that's really a connection that we may not have kind of noticed at the time. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the payoff for this actually comes in book four, which is out in June, which is the Boris Johnson years. But if you go back to sort of April and May of 2018, Labour was doing pretty well in the polls. I think people thought they were going to do all right in the local elections. And three things all happened in very quick succession. One of which was that the Russians tried to poison the Skripal in Salisbury, and Jeremy Corbyn took the view that he'd rather believe what the Kremlin had to say about it than what British intelligence was saying about it. The second thing was that there was then a chemical weapons attack by the Assad regime in Syria, and in Westminster they decided they wanted to react to that, and Corbyn again opposed it and kind of suggested that he didn't really believe the basis for that. And then the anti-Semitism crisis took off in Labour, and that from that point onwards, Corbyn's personal ratings plummet, Labour's ratings go down, they lose a whole load of seats. Jewish voters in places like Barnet switched to the Tories that spring, and a lot of them haven't gone back yet. They may go back at the upcoming election. But what that meant was that Corbyn was not regarded as a sort of, by most sort of general mainstream opinion in Westminster, as a viable national leader or someone who could bring together a coalition of kind of Remainers to come up with a version of softer Brexit. There was a majority in the House of Commons for a soft Brexit and nobody found it. And particularly in 2019, a little bit in the spring, but mostly over the summer and into the autumn, there was all this talk of GNU, the Government of National Unity, where various people were going to get together, pass a bill or pass the deal and then call an election. But nobody wanted Jeremy Corbyn running that, apart from Jeremy Corbyn and half a dozen people around him. And he'd kind of contaminated his brand and that of Labour. And that, you know, again, it was a problem for Theresa May that she didn't have sort of viable people she could do business with at the top of the Labour Party. But it also meant that it helped Boris Johnson later, because it meant that, you know, nobody was able to locate that kind of Remainer sort of majority in the Commons.
I think in your conclusion in the book, you say that essentially Theresa May made Boris Johnson necessary. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, lots of people sort of have taken the view that, you know, she made him inevitable. But I think for most people in the Conservative Party, she'd kind of exhausted every possible option. She'd tried the sort of halfway house deal. She'd tried something that was a bit closer economically. She'd talked about the strength of the union. But she'd persuaded neither the mainstream body. I mean, she had the mainstream body of opinion in her own party on the back benches just about with her. But even moderate Brexiteers thought that she'd made a mess of this. And the Remainer forces in the Commons, you know, which all had their different views. Some wanted a Norway solution, some wanted to be in the customs union, some wanted a referendum. They all never agreed, but what they did agree on was that they didn't like Theresa May's deal too much. And what she succeeded in doing was alienating every single body of opinion, so that at the end, you know, what might have been a deliverable kind of deal in sort of late 2017, by the time we get to mid 2019, there were only really two options left, which were sort of referendum and revoke or no deal. And she successfully turned every single other faction against herself.
Mm. And just finally, do you think our relationship with the EU is settled? I mean, recently the EU made an offer to Labour to kind of bring back a version of free movement for under 30s. Labour's kind of said that they're not interested. Do you think that will change in the coming years?
Well, I flatly don't believe they're not interested. I suspect that they will be interested at some point. And if you go back to when you get to Boris Johnson's negotiations in book four, it's very clear that they would have offered him more if they'd thought he was up for some kind of mobility agreement. And that will be a situation that Keir Starmer finds himself in. You know, the EU is not just a passive force sitting there going, no, 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 we don't want that. They have views of their own, and that's one of the things they'd like. I think the first thing Labour will kind of turn to is likely to be a security deal. You know, the prospect of another Trump presidency puts that probably a little bit higher up the inbox than talking about mobility deals. And obviously, Starmer has to be careful that he doesn't go and alienate all those people who lent their vote to the Tories but might be willing to look again at the Labour Party. But is it settled? No, it's not settled. And frankly, it never will be, because if you talk to the Norwegians or the Swiss or all the other people who have a kind of semi-detached relationship with the EU, it's a constant process of negotiation. The Swiss had 100-odd deals, and a lot of them have been rewritten already. There's a natural moment where we can think about these things in Britain, because in 2025, there's supposed to be a kind of revisit on the Trade and Commerce Agreement, which is the Christmas Eve deal that Johnson signed in 2020. But actually, behind the scenes, Sunak has had two moments where he's kind of redrawn the relationship, the Windsor Agreement, and then there was another sort of tweak to satisfy the DUP a couple of months back. But behind the scenes, the kind of practical problems with the TCA are being quietly worked on all the time. And actually, because there's a bit less sound and fury now, and it's not Boris Johnson sort of shouting everything from the rooftops, the civil service and the European Commission have been quietly beavering away, trying to sort of come to pragmatic arrangements on a range of things. Now, that won't represent a new deal, but it will sort of iron out some of the problems with the existing one. But what that means for Starmer is that if he wants to go much further, there isn't much sort of low-hanging fruit of this is just completely crazy the way this is operating, because we're kind of dealing with those things privately. If he wants to do anything more, it will have to be kind of a recognisable new deal, and that will bring everything to a head. And right now, if he started talking about that, I rather suspect it would frighten the horses amongst a lot of Leave voters, and that's not what he wants to do. But this is going to keep going and going and going forever. You know, our position vis-a-vis Europe will continue to evolve. My personal view is that we'll end up in some kind of outer ring with a probably slightly closer economic relationship than we've got now, but outside the political institutions. And frankly, that's pretty much what David Cameron wanted, just inside the political institutions. And it will have taken, you know, probably 10 or 15 years to get to that position once the temperature's taken out of it. But if Starmer moves too quickly, the temperature will very quickly rise and go back into it. And any prime minister who tries to do anything too radical is going to have big problems, I think.
So stay tuned for more Brexit. Tim, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And finally, why are book clubs so fraught? Flora Watkins writes in the magazine this week about the toxicity of book clubs, specifically the Jilly Cooper book club that she was booted out of after one of the group chats turned toxic. The group chat descended into arguments about vaccines and transgender politics, and she joined us alongside author and journalist Elisa Seagrave. I started by asking Flora to take us through her experience with the Jilly Cooper book club.
Well, it's just so desperately sad, because for several years it was brilliant fun, a group of like-minded women who loved Jilly Cooper. We were all, you know, all bright, educated women who appreciated Jilly's writing. Jilly Cooper herself got to hear of our existence and invited us all down to have lunch with her in Gloucestershire, which was just fabulous. She is wonderful. And then a WhatsApp group was set up, and it was just one friend said, oh, it's such a lovely thing to have in your pocket. And it really was. So, you know, anything from makeup tips. So what can anyone recommend, a good illuminating primer to? It got very busy over Christmas when we would all be sort of rushing off to the spare room to message each other about how on earth do we cope with these ghastly relatives who've descended. And then, I don't know, there were fault lines before lockdown, but it did seem to become increasingly, not polarised, but there was certainly seemed to be a group think on certain issues. I remember most people felt that the lockdowns were a good idea. I very much didn't. And there were various spats, and I spent more and more time not being on the group than on it. And then one of the members has become very, very vocal in her radical trans rights advocacy. And normally I just scroll past it. And then it was on another platform, it was on Instagram, I saw something that sort of branded all women that think that trans women are trans women and not women are hateful. And I just thought, no, I'm not taking this. And extraordinarily, it's Gilly Cooper, a writer who is pretty clear about who is what gender, has inadvertently dragged me into the gender wars. I've been very reticent about putting my head above the parapet before. And then we had this unedifying spat. And then I woke up the next morning to a really horrible volley of messages on the WhatsApp group, sort of public shaming, and was told to F off for good, from us for good. It was very much us and you, and F off from us. And that was that. And bar a couple of members who called and messaged and, you know, offered support and said that they thought this was awful, haven't heard from anyone since. It's all just come to an end. And throughout this, I just thought, hang on, this is a book club set up by women, for women, to celebrate a woman writer who has largely, by male critics, been mocked, had the P taken out of her. She's a very easy target for writers like Craig Brown, who I also love, but, you know, as Julie said to us, he's bitched me up for 40 years. To celebrate a woman writer, and I've been booted out because I was told I was on the wrong side of history on gender.
Elisa, what do you make of all of that? You've written previously about book clubs. What's been your experience of book clubs?
Well, this rather similar thing happened in my village. This was before I resigned from my own book club several years ago in London. So I was asked by this woman who'd come into the village, who joined a book club, whether I could talk one evening about a book on my mother. She'd read the book. We seemed to get on very well. So a few months later, I texted her to say, oh, do you still want me to come in September? It was already September. And then I got this rather... Oh, no, what was really annoying, they'd suddenly put this on the village notice board. Small Friendly Village Book Club is looking for 3 or 4 new members. No, I'd been cancelled because I'd put on the notice board, someone else had an email I'd sent correcting a council meeting where a woman in the chair of the council being totally misrepresented, you know, slandered. So as a result, I got the text from the woman who'd asked me to come and talk. There are many hurt feelings in the village. We in the book group believe your email put on the parish council notice board was hurtful and upsetting. So the feeling is at the moment would be better to postpone your visit. My email was totally factual. All it did was correct certain statements in the village newsletter, which was totally biased against the council. And so this is ridiculous. It's the same thing as Flora. It wasn't as bad as... I mean, hurt seems to be a current buzzword for those who don't share others' views. I said, I don't know why people are so nasty. And this was also in lockdown. It got worse in lockdown, all this kind of thing in our village.
If you need to advertise your book club as friendly, therein is possibly a problem.
I mean, I'm still not really saying hello to this woman. What's it? I mean, I'm not sort of blanking her, but there's a funny atmosphere when I see her in the shop and outside. But the annoying thing is we got on extremely well. If this hadn't happened, she obviously had pressure from the other members because she wanted to please them because she just moved in, I suppose, and be part of the village. So I was sort of cast out. But I hate this group bullying. It's this group
yes, it
bullying
was plain
everywhere.
Old-fashioned bullying is actually what it was in the end.
Yes, exactly.
Effort from us. Bye! And an exclamation mark. I mean, real... mean girl stuff
yes.
from a group of 40-something educated women.
Exactly.
Flora, since your defenestration from the Gilly Cooper Book Club, you've heard of other women's stories, and it does seem that there is a kind of trend here with, as you say in your piece, there often being a kind of Ayatollah figure who controls the book club and more of a kind of political feel to these clubs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the word Ayatollah I may come to regret. I would just like to put in a very quick word for my current book club, which is brilliant. I'm moving to a part of the country where we knew very few people. I was thrilled to be invited. And actually, a book club does need a gatekeeper to ensure that you are going to chat about the book, but not veer into Ayatollah territory. I heard this morning a friend texted me to say, I left my book club because you were expected to write notes, you know, like it was a university seminar. But the book club I'm in now works, I think, because the gatekeeper is quite gentle and we use the WhatsApp group for meetups, what are we going to read next, and practical stuff, and not pseudo group therapy. But yes, it's a bit like, I think it was Billy Connolly who made that quip that the desire to be a politician should ban you from being one for life. I think possibly the desire to set up a book club should cancel you from doing that for life, because it does seem to bring out despotic tendencies. You know, it's that you're either not literary enough or you're too literary. I was once told I was arrogant because this is a book club I was in 20 years ago when I was working in BBC local radio, and I was invited by a family friend. All my friends had graduated and were living the life of Riley in London, and I was bored in local radio. A friend was doing a degree as a mature student in English literature at Essex University. So I went along to her book club, and the Ayatollah there was this terrifying woman who physically looked like Lady Antonia Fraser and acted like Lady Catherine de Bourgh. And she just seemed to want to crush the views of anyone who was under 30. And we read, oh God, what was the book? A Short History of Tractors in Ukraine. And I said, everyone thought it was marvellous. I just said, sorry, I thought it was crap. I mean, and I said, why are we reading Richard and Judy book club stuff? And I was carpeted by her and told I was arrogant and, yeah, maybe.
Just finally, Elisa, do you think maybe there's something quite neurotic about bookish people?
No, I think there's so many people read, so unexpected people read books. No, I don't think it's that. I think it's a group thing. I mean, when I was young, I knew all these people were in a commune down in South London. But there was this couple running it. They was doing it like some sort of Maoist thing, and they became very nasty. One woman was hit on the head with rolled up copies of The Guardian because she played jazz. It was considered very decadent. I think it's nothing to do with books. I think it's group things can get very nasty. I
mean, WhatsApp groups in particular, perhaps. I mean, my husband, I was relating all this to him, and he looked up from his laptop and said, you're all bloody mad. I mean, his WhatsApp group is his old rugby club. And the chat never really gets above, oh, Val Torrens next year, mate, and that sort of thing. Exactly. But maybe it's women and WhatsApp groups are the problem as well. I don't know.
And that's everything this week. We've been reading a lot of your feedback, and thank you very much. We're always looking for ways to improve the podcast, so it's really helpful to have your thoughts. Do keep them coming in to podcast@spectator.co.uk. And as ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, you can read everything that Gus and I have talked about, as well as plenty more. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Gus Carter, and we hope you'll join us again next week.